This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Erica D. Smith, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Steve Chiatakis. Let's wander through the closest thing Topanga has to a downtown. It's right off the main Canyon Road, which weaves through the Santa Monica Mountains on its way to the beach. It's the middle of the week. Most of Topanga's businesses are closed. There's just one guy sitting at a picnic table in the small shaded arcade, playing a guitar.
Have my heart ever been so hard?
Shane Burroughs hangs out here most days. All the shop owners know him. This is a song he recently wrote.
How could I not care about people on the street? How could I not care about the trash beneath my feet?
Burroughs lives in his car in Topanga Canyon. He says he spent most of his life here, and now he's facing mounting pressure to leave. That's because homeowners here, and in other Southern California neighborhoods surrounded by dry brush, are worried their homeless neighbors could spark a fire that would devastate their community. In fact, one Topanga resident reached out to KCRW specifically to ask what's being done to mitigate the fire risk from homeless encampments. The answer is actually a lot. Turns out it's a hot-button issue that's only gotten hotter this year. KCRW's Kaylee Wells picks up the story from here.
Sabine Niederberghaus has one of the riskiest properties here. The land between her home and a stunning ocean view is shaped like a bowl, giving any wildfire a straight shot to her home. In fact, a house that was here before burned down in the 1993 Topanga fire. Niederberghaus bought the empty lot that remained. As recently as last July, a wildfire got within a few miles of her home before firefighters put it out.
So I decided to start a new initiative, and I said we all have to get together and we have to do something about this because we know where the fires are coming from, where they are started, what the cause of the fires is, and we have to make the situation better and we have to take our own initiative.
She started a neighborhood group, and she hosted fire safety meetings for dozens of Topanga residents, where they discussed their concerns about fires, including the risk of fire from people living in tents or cars in the canyons.
I don't say that the fires are caused by homeless or encampment. I call it by human behavior, irresponsible human behavior.
Topanga Town Council member Carrie Carrier says preventing fire is not just important to protect homes. When fire comes, the homeless residents are in the greatest danger.
If a fast-moving wildfire or brush fire that turns into a wildfire comes through, it theoretically could go from one point of the canyon to the other in a matter of a couple of hours, 2.5, 3 hours. Meanwhile, it would probably take us between 5 to 7 hours to actually evacuate every single known resident of the canyon. So you can see where the unhoused themselves are at such extreme risk should a wildfire tear through the area that it's just literally puts their lives, I would say, most in peril of all, because they have the least reliable way of being informed of a fire and being evacuated in the event of a fire.
Old timers in Topanga know what a worst case scenario looks like. In 1993, the old Topanga fire burned down 359 homes and killed three people. Shane Burroughs, the guitar player, he remembers.
It was amazing to see. It was like, you can't describe. It's like bring on the frogs falling out of the sky, and, you know, it was biblical.
As he reminisces, he removes the reading glasses he uses to play guitar. He's wearing a pair of jeans, a hat that says Topanga, and beat up white tennis shoes.
I had friends who lost their pets and all, you know, their lifetime worth of studio recordings, irreplaceable stuff. Yeah, it's not a good thing.
Now, in the midst of an historic drought, Topanga residents are worried they're overdue for another devastating wildfire. They've already had a few close calls this year. The Palisades fire back in May forced 1,000 residents to evacuate. And there have been a couple fires in nearby Tuna Canyon that were easily extinguished. Firefighters say some of them sparked near known encampments of unhoused residents.
We hear that Topanga residents, and frankly others in unincorporated mountain areas, were really worried.
This is LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl, whose district includes Topanga. Last month, the Board of Supervisors voted to ban homeless encampments in high fire risk areas.
We're now worried about the danger that they pose. They don't mean to pose a danger. And so we want to help move them. I mean, it doesn't mean that they can't still, you know, be homeless somewhere. It just means they can't be homeless in these zones. It's just too dangerous to everybody.
So now the Sheriff's Department has been instructed to find everyone camped in high fire risk areas of unincorporated LA County, offer them shelter, and make sure they move. The Sheriff's Department didn't respond to multiple requests for comment, but residents say they've heard that homeless outreach deputies have been by more often recently.
Good luck.
Burroughs says there's no way that'll work.
Well, I can only speak for myself. This is my home. You know, I would never... That's it. This is my home. This town is, you know, I'm not going anywhere.
Plus, Burroughs says it's not just unhoused residents sparking the fires here.
I always blame the homeless people. That always... Look at the proportion of homeless fires caused in comparison to other things, you know? Accidents, people's mufflers, people dirt biking, people shooting.
Burroughs lives in his car and says he mostly doesn't need fire.
So light cigarettes, maybe an occasional bowl.
And he says, if anything, people living outside are more savvy about wildfire.
The homeless people around here are your first line of defense because they're the people who are going to find out first, you know, what's going on. And at least up here, we tend to, you know, want to preserve our life up here, you know, and other people's lives. So it's not in our interest to let anything run amok.
That doesn't comfort the homeowners in Topanga. Plus, Kuehl says she's confident that most people will be willing to move.
I don't know. It's sticky and hard. But, you know, the truth is most homeless people do not turn down a bed. It's not like, oh, I love being out here and, you know, dying slowly in the open air. It's not fun to be homeless.
As for Burroughs?
All the people I love here outside of my immediate family are in this town. Been here all, you know, my entire adult life.
He'll do what he can to stay because he's made a life for himself in the canyon. And for 33 years, he's called Topanga home. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
How could I not care about people on the street? How could I not care about the trash beneath my feet? I try not to think.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Erica D. Smith. The LA Board of Education met earlier today to vote on a COVID vaccine mandate for eligible students. Under the plan, students who attend classes in person or who use district facilities will be required to get the vaccine if they are 12 or older. That is, unless they have a valid medical or religious exemption. The mandate could take effect as early as November. Students would need to be fully vaccinated by the end of winter break. The Board of Education released this statement yesterday that said, quote, "Science clearly shows that vaccinations are an essential part of protecting our communities." Culver City Unified also has announced a vaccine mandate. Other school districts, including Santa Monica, Malibu, Beverly Hills, and Baldwin Hills, are said to be considering one as well. Jackie Goldberg is on the LAUSD School Board, and she joins me now. Welcome, Jackie.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Erica.
So you said that you support this mandate. Where do your fellow board members stand?
What we have seen, and we've studied this considerably, is that hospitalization rates for children and in young adults are 5 times higher in August than they were in June. But guess what? Unvaccinated adolescents 12 to 17, 10 times higher rate of hospitalizations than fully vaccinated adolescents. We believe that it is essential to keeping kids and adults and everyone in the community safe to have the highest rate of vaccination possible. And therefore, we believe, like vaccines for polio or for smallpox or measles, they should be required.
So what if any exemptions would be allowed?
Well, there are exemptions under special education, for example. There could be exemptions that would be done in an IEP. There are exemptions for sure for students who have various types of health issues underlying. There are exemptions for students who might have one or more of the ingredients of the vaccine they are allergic to, and they've seen that already. So there are those exemptions. Religious exemptions are a lot harder. The state has outlawed most religious exemptions for students in school after the measles outbreak at Disneyland, you may recall. So we don't have as much flexibility about that one, although we will certainly look at each case, case by case.
So, you know, LAUSD has already have some of the most aggressive coronavirus testing and quarantine policies in the country, and there have already been legal challenges. Do you expect to have some sort of similar pushback over a mandate for vaccines?
Well, we get sued by everybody for everything all the time. It's kind of a semi-competitive indoor sport these days. So, yes, we're assuming we will be sued. But, you know, we've looked at some of the case history with our legal advisors. And, you know, it's essentially an issue that says that the district is both a local education agency, but it's also an agency of the state for purposes of implementing educational policy and operating public schools. So since that is our charge, we believe it is appropriate for us to legally require this. However, of course, we will get sued and it will be settled in court. But in the meantime, what we will be doing is saving lives.
Vaccines have been available for those that are 12 and older for several months now. But as of August 29th, the statistics I'm reading, you know, fewer than half of 12 to 15 year olds were fully vaccinated. So do you expect that this mandate would push more people, more teenagers to get the shot?
Absolutely. If they want to go to school at LA Unified in second semester, they're going to have to get vaccinated before the second semester opens after winter break. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be, because we know it's controversial. We know that there are people who don't believe in mandates of any types. Well, God bless you. I mean, I'm very happy you don't believe in mandates. But you know what? We'd have polio now. See, I'm old enough to remember polio. You're not. But I am. I remember polio. And if we had not vaccinated virtually every kid, we would still be having polio outbreaks in Los Angeles schools. So I'm not happy when people tell me that they don't want me to tell you what to do. I'm sorry. If you don't want me to tell you what to do, don't go to our schools, because we're going to try to keep your children safe regardless of what your politics are.
For kids who do get the exemption, or for those who don't get vaccinated for one reason or another, will there be an independent study option for those students?
Well, there are two different groups. The kids who get exemptions will be allowed on campus and just will be tested more frequently. The kids who do not get vaccinated and cannot qualify for an exemption will be not allowed to continue with in-person education in LA Unified. We have the independent studies program, and they will all be enrolled in independent studies. We intend to continue everyone's education, but we do not intend to continue everyone's education with unvaccinated students posing a threat to their vaccinated peers.
Mm-hmm. So what would this mean for testing and quarantine and even masking policies if theoretically all students are vaccinated?
Well, I'm sure that'll all change, to be honest with you, but we don't know yet. We have to wait and see if we can actually get to full vaccination. Certainly, the more vaccinated, high vaccination rates will reduce the outdoor masking for sure. We just don't know when. I suspect if I were a betting person, we'd continue masking through the entire first semester of this school year, because that gives everybody time to get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Is there an ideal percentage you're looking for before those policies would change?
Yeah, 100%. No, but seriously, we think we can get pretty close to that. We're very close to that with the adults now. And the adult infection rate on our campuses is now at 0.15% and trending down. That means 15 one-hundredths of 1% for employees reporting to work sites.
Yeah. Speaking of teachers, I mean, the LA Teachers Union has been pushing for tighter quarantine rules, even though some parents are arguing that's unnecessary. Do you support the union's proposal for a 10-day quarantine for unvaccinated students who are exposed to?
We're not going to change our quarantine protocols anytime soon, I don't think. And we're not going to certainly go up to those large numbers of days unless we see a scientific reason to do so, which right now we don't seem to have.
Okay. You know, according to the LA Times, about 1,600 COVID cases have been linked to schools as of September 6th, but only 5 were tied to transmission on campus. So,
yes.
So how does that bode
well,
for
it's
the...
It's working, but it's not going to work forever because not only do we have the Delta virus, which is highly contagious, which kids are getting mostly in the community and bringing to school, but sometimes the kids, when they get them in the community and they bring them to school, they spread them to other neighborhoods that were not getting infected. That's why we don't want to have this. Because even if you catch a kid the day after, they've already been on campus. Because, you know, you only test once a week. We don't test 5 days a week. So this is a precaution that has life-saving as its goal and has reducing the amount of interference COVID plays in our daily school lives by reducing the risk dramatically by vaccinating 12 to 17-year-olds.
As you mentioned, you know, the likelihood of lawsuits is going to be there. There's going to be parents who are going to be upset with what happened. Across the country, we've noticed how school board meetings have increasingly become battlegrounds for parents who either support or oppose vaccines and masks. So, you know, how do you lower the temperature going forward on these debates?
It's very hard to do because the vast majority of people who oppose vaccinating children at our schools don't have any children in our schools. I look through my emails and, you know, the ones that have children in our schools say, hi, I'm a parent of 2 here and 1 there. 90% of my emails in the last 24 hours have not started with the sentence that I have a kid in your schools. So I don't think the parents are opposed to this. In fact, parents at one of my last town hall meetings said, when are you going to require it? They're afraid for their children right now. And the parents at the elementary schools where the kids are under 12 are the ones that are most asking to be independent study because their kids cannot get vaccinated. So what you really have are a bunch of people who have ideological oppositions to vaccinations, and they are making all the noise. They are not the parents of our students. Now, I won't say there are no parents of our students who will oppose that. Of course there are parents of our students who will oppose it. We have 419,136 students in person every day.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Jackie Goldberg is a member of the LAUSD School Board. Thanks again for speaking with us.
Happy to be with you. Thanks for inviting me.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Erica D. Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis. Let's take a trip to Montebello, east of East LA, where an empty lot that has sat vacant for nearly a decade is having a renaissance. I'm talking about Boulevard Market. It's a new food hall at the corner of Whittier Boulevard and South 6th Street, where you can eat and drink to your heart's content. It's made up of 7 repurposed shipping containers, 2 indoor kitchens, and a beer garden. The market serves as an incubator for emerging restaurateurs, but it's also raising some questions about gentrification. Mona Holmes is a reporter at Eater LA and a regular contributor here on Greater LA. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Erica.
So Boulevard Market opened in August, and you stopped by to check it out. What's it like?
Boulevard Market is this unique little spot. It's a cozy, bright corner of Montebello, which is 20 minutes away from my home in Northeast LA. It's impossible to miss. Just look on the north side of the street for a collection of white shipping containers. And when you walk in, it's got a central seating area that absolutely is reminiscent of a beer garden with bench seatings, strings of lights, umbrellas, and a playlist that's pumping out hip-hop, underground music, 90s R&B, reggaeton, nostalgic sounds. And it's a really cozy place that feels like a neighborhood spot where people are bringing their kids, their dogs, And if they're sitting in, if you're sitting in the middle of that courtyard, you're surrounded by food vendors. And it's a really wonderful vibe. And it's all from one of the co-founders, Barney Santos. And it's one of my new favorite places to be.
That sounds really cool. You know, but this is hardly the first shipping container food hall in SoCal. There's one in Garden Grove, one in Bellflower, one in Long Beach. What makes this one stand out?
Well, the difference with this one is Barney's incubator program. I first met him in 2018 when he invited me to meet the businesses that were going to take their businesses to the next level by being within Boulevard Market. And I mean, that was back when there was no building. They had a building site, but they hadn't bought it yet. Everything was brand new. And while incubator programs are not unusual in the restaurant industry, this one is pretty great. It's a two-year program that's designed to accelerate the growth of a restaurant or a food vendor. But it's so unique that the health department even had trouble classifying them. Because there isn't really a space in LA County where a business can find everything that they need and ready to go on site, where they can access customers, serve customers right away, but it's designed to make everyone fly on their own. And it was all based on what he told me was that all these socioeconomic barriers for restaurant ownership for minority-owned businesses, he saw them, and so he wanted to do something to remedy that. And he's got these businesses going and has a really great space for locals or even those in surrounding Montebello to come and visit.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about a business that's gone through or a vendor that's gone through Barney's program that you checked out at the market.
I'd love to. I've been talking to some of them for a couple of years, but one of them is Los Taquero Mucho, which is family owned by Miguel Sylvia and Alex Garcia. Alex and Sylvia are husband and wife, and they do tacos with some inspiration from Guatemala. They have never worked in the food industry before. And Sylvia worked in banking. I mean, it was pretty bold of them to just leave their cushy jobs to try and open up a food business. But they're much happier. They're really sweet and kind people that make excellent food. They started in their backyard. They started catering events. And they approached Barney to go through the incubator program, and they did it.
So in addition to that one, what other food stalls did you try?
I also love Nola's Cajun Cuisine by Caven Cross. His family owned a restaurant in Hermosa Beach for 17 years called New Orleans Cajun and Creole, and that's where he got his first job when he was a teenager. But he was also working as an adult in operations and food nutrition at USC's Keck Medicine. But he still had a dream to open up his own restaurant. And so he had a business plan. He met with Barney. And the next thing you know, he's got a coveted slot in a repurposed shipping container and selling amazing foods that are all based on, you know, New Orleans recipes.
So it sounds like, you know, Barney is really trying to revitalize downtown Montebello. From your reporting, do you get the sense that that's what the residents and the community wants?
You know, until I visited Boulevard, I hadn't spoken to anyone who lives in the surrounding community. But sitting there on a midweek afternoon a few weeks ago, there were so many locals there, just sitting, chilling, just eating food. And there was a couple that brought their own deck of cards to play and relax while drinking a beer. Another family came and just, you could tell that they just wanted an area to meet outside. And I would absolutely say that the locals are feeling this place. And from what Barney tells me, during the week, it's mostly locals. And on the weekends, they get visitors from outside of the area. So yeah, it really is something to behold because the lot sat vacant for a decade and people were wondering what was going to go in.
Mona Holmes, reporter for Eater LA. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Next week, we'll head to a tribal plant nursery in Santa Barbara's wine country. There, native Chumash people are preserving seeds that are significant to their food and culture. Also, for a long time, we thought that the future of transportation would be all about flying cars. You know, like the Jetsons. But why is that? That and more next week on GLA. Check out the show anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, and Holly Adams all had a hand in today's show.
I'm LA Times columnist Erica D. Smith. This is Greater LA. Thanks for listening.